Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Mardrigan. A 65-year-old woman has turned single motherhood into an extreme sport. She's already the mother of 13. She's now pregnant with quadruplets. Is this an abuse of reproductive medicine or a modern-day miracle? Joining us on the line for his take on this and other medical ethical issues is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center and host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Hello there, Art.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
You know, Art, thinking about this 65-year-old woman, I was thinking about whatever happened to Octomom. Remember her?
I do.
How many children did she have? Like 19?
That's why she was called Octo, right?
A single deliver.
Yeah, and then she had a bunch more. And this woman does, too. She's had 12 children by 5 different men, ages 22 to 44. And now at 65, she's pregnant with quadruplets. Enlarging her family to 17 children. So you think this is a little out of line, Art?
I do. I think it's absurd and irresponsible. I can't believe any clinic anywhere in the world, and she's in Germany, but she didn't have it done there, would take her on as a patient. 65 years old, when you're female, you're trying to carry the baby in your body. That is an automatic high-risk pregnancy for the fetuses. When you have four together, it's an automatic high-risk pregnancy. They're going to be born with disabilities. I don't think they'll ever make it to term. She'll have to be C-sections, which is another risk for her at that age. Some people are going to say to me, well, you know, we don't do anything about men who have children when they're 65 and older, but they don't carry the babies to term, and they don't try to do four all at once. So I think there's an asymmetry. There's a male-female difference here, and I think it makes an ethics difference.
Well, I think there is a symmetry. Maybe there's not a biological symmetry, but we just read this week Billy Joel's wife is pregnant. He's 65. I think Tony Randall was like 90 or whatever he was, 80 yeah. or something. There are a ton of guys in this circumstance. My concern...
By the way, there's Larry King. There's
of course, that's
Eastwood.
Right. So I was about to say my concern is something other than that. Obviously, I have the concerns for the baby and the mother that you do. But you also voiced in a piece you wrote, with which I could not agree more, the likelihood is pretty good the parent's going to be dead when the kid is in high school or some such thing, which is really shortchanging that child. No, I mean, that's a huge issue, too.
It is. And so another round of reasons why this is a bad idea, if you're going to be entering a nursing home when your kid enters high school, and you know that, that's bad. That's really a bad thing. And if you're not headed in that direction, and I don't want to hear all the 65 is the new 55 kind of stuff. You just look at the statistics. There's a lot of Alzheimer's, a lot of osteoporosis, a lot of frailty, a lot of chronic disease when you get to be 80.
Does any country have any legal limitations on what, I assume never on the man, but on what the woman can do after a certain age, or is it all, what is the state of the law?
Mm. So Germany does. That's why she had to leave.
Oh.
A few other countries do. We don't. We, however, have surrogacy. Hiring a surrogate mother is illegal in a number of states in America, but that's about it. Anybody could saunter up there and say, I want to have a baby. And by the way, a single male could use donor eggs and hire a surrogate and at 80 decide to have a child that way. It has been done. It's not common, but I've seen it, and I have the same gripes about that. You don't really get much of a vetting, so that you have people who are single and no money and maybe mentally ill. This is going to sound unbelievable, but years ago, there was one guy who did what I just said, used a surrogate mom and donor eggs, and he had a long history of being a child molester.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah. So the industry, the infertility industry, and I use that term deliberately, keeps saying, well, we're heavily regulated and don't worry about us. And, you know, the FDA keeps an eye on our labs. That's all true, but that's all the safety features. There's no rules about who can use this technology. If you have the money, you could find somebody to do it.
You know, Art, these are outliers, obviously, these people that are 60 and 65 having quadruplets.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see hordes of 65-year-old
No, we're not. But, you know, there's a bigger picture now that I think is something that down the road it would be fascinating to look at, is a lot of women are waiting, especially women with you know, these hotshot careers of going to graduate school and stuff, waiting till their late 30s or early 40s to have babies. And I just know myself, I mean, physically you are much different in terms of childbearing at 42 than you are at 29. And that's, you know, getting up all night long with a newborn baby, mm-hmm. and the physical, mm-hmm. it's amazing to me that things seem to go so well, because 42 is not 25, you know?
Right. You do lose some of the energy, some of the body just ages no matter how far you jog, Jim, no matter how many kumquats you eat. It doesn't matter. There's just aging that does take place. So that's true. I know some listeners are thinking, but wait a minute, you know, their grandparents were raising kids because the mom or the dad couldn't do it or got sick or died or something. I understand that. People adapt. But the question is, do you want to set up this situation? One thing that drives me nuts, Marjorie, is you go on the talk show circuit and you see celebrity women come out and they say, oh, I'm having a baby at 42.
Yeah.
They don't say they did it with donor eggs and they did it with in vitro fertilization. If you're past 40, the odds of you getting pregnant with your own eggs by birds and bees sex are pretty tiny. I mean, they're really small. So unless you're going to freeze your eggs when you're 22 or 29, older eggs, they don't work as well. We know that. Infertility rates go way up after 35. People start having problems and issues. It isn't just this kind of, oh, the technology will fix it. Everything will be fine.
Yeah. You know, Art, last thing on this. By the way, we should add a few more men. Charlie Chaplin, 73. Robert De Niro, 68. Steve Martin, 67. One last quick thing. You say there aren't rules. Should there be rules?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we need to have kind of adoption-like rules. Do you have money? Do you have a house? Are you mentally ill? Those would be nice rules. I like that. And if you're going to do this, do you have someone that you've arranged to take care of the child or children if you pass on? So who's going to step in for this woman? She's had 13 kids by 5 fathers. No one's ever asked who the sperm supplier was. I don't know. Maybe she used a donor for that, too. I don't know. But you'd want somebody to say, look, if we're going to do this at an older age, and I think 65 is way old, but even at 45, who will raise the kids if something happens?
Yeah. So Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, we talked about this with you last week, but there was a huge story again this week in the New York Times about this couple out in Iowa, the Rahans. They're a loving couple, got married later in life, second marriage, and the husband is now on trial at 78 years old, charged with third-degree felony sexual abuse for having sex with his wife, who has serious dementia. I mean, there's absolutely no question about that. And what I guess I still can't believe, the more I read about this, okay, maybe he shouldn't have done it. Maybe there is some question about whether you can consent when you have a big-time dementia. But this guy is charged with a crime, loving couple by everybody's testimony. It just seems odd. It got to this.
Right. So this has an ethics category description. We call this mishugana. That means it is completely nuts. This is crazyville. A third-degree felony?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, whatever else you want to say, maybe they should sit down and have a talk and say, look, let's establish a policy here. You might hurt her, or we're not sure whether she would really want this. Can you convince us that she would think it would be okay? I have a feeling that there may be some family dynamics.
Exactly. The daughters don't like it. That stepdad is in there with their mom. I think that's what it seems to be about. But what's amazing is the authorities went for this. And again, you know, this guy is visiting his wife morning and night, praying the rosary by her bedside. Everybody says
He was a state legislator, too.
He was a state legislator. Who didn't run for office again this time. And the other thing that I find interesting is that you have the experts in the field saying that the touch is one of the last things to go, and that maybe if she loved this guy, she enjoyed having a sexual relationship with him.
Right, and Alzheimer's people, you know, they still like their meals. They watch television. It's not that everything is evaporated. I don't know whether she would like this intimacy or wouldn't like it. I do know a couple of other things, though. One is there's no place in most of our nursing homes and long-term care facilities to do this, even if she was mentally with it. We don't have private areas, so the reason is that kids and grandkids don't like to think of the old folks as having sex, and some do, and some would like to. And by the way, some want to do it with people they're not married to because they form a romance in this You know, by
the
way,
for those who are listening to Marjorie, who's obsessed with this thing, I should say the last 2 weeks, in the same New York Times article, experts are talking about how this is a huge issue with people living longer, with dementia being as widespread as it is. It's not some outlier, curious issue in this individual case, but an issue that's got to be confronted by policymakers at some point, which frankly would never have occurred to me had it not been for this pathetic case. In any case,
I thought you were going to say it had not been for Marjorie. But again, you know, the other group that's going to have to get on the ball here is architects. If you're going to design these buildings, you need to make a private space, a private area, let's say just for people to go and be together, even if they're not going to have sex. They're just going to hold hands, or they want some place where the roommate isn't there. You know, this is kind of like college gone crazy. What are these people doing? Putting a tie on the door if they're, you know, inside the room and having at it?
It's more privacy if they go to prison, by the way, in most cases.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, the young people being, you know, appalled and repulsed at older people having sex. I'll never forget, you know, reading 5 or 6 years ago what they call the sports pages for women, you know, the wedding section of the New York Times, this 80-year-old couple that met in some assisted living facility. Remember the husband saying, because they featured their wedding, I felt like I was 16. And I thought that was so great. And here they are, these people that love each other, and it just seems, I mean, I certainly hope they're not going to send this guy to jail. That's all I can say.
So just to feed your obsession on this one.
Yeah, that's right.
The other thing that is a double whammy here is we don't like to talk about what's going to happen or what we want when we have Alzheimer's or terminal illness. And now add in, we don't like to talk about sex. And boy, you have a really great opportunity not to talk about something that's very, very important.
We're talking to Art Kaplan, medical ethicist extraordinaire from NYU. Art, a survey out this week from Gallup and some other organizations saying that 90% of Americans, 9 out of 10 adults, now have health insurance as a result of the Affordable Care Act. We all know that its fate is hanging in the balance with the Supreme Court. But I have a question about the 90%. I've been searching around and not been very successful. You know the old line, the good news is you have health insurance. The bad news is you can't afford to use it because of deductibles, co-pays, that sort of thing.
Right.
Has there been any analysis done about that? About, yes, we know the good news is there's expansion of access. I hope people think that's good news. But how good are the policies that most people are getting under this expansion?
Yeah, I haven't seen good studies of that. I'll make two comments about it. One, you know, it's an expansion of insurance, which is not the same as an expansion of access.
Mm-hmm.
People who have Medicaid will tell you there are a lot of doctors who don't want to take Medicaid patients. I don't think they get paid enough. So it doesn't mean just because you've got a form of insurance you're going to get in the door. The other problem is it doesn't mean you've got a provider. So what I mean by that is if you went around Massachusetts and said, how long do people have to wait to find a new general practitioner, family medicine doc, maybe an internist? The wait lists were pretty bad, and they're only going to get worse because if you give people insurance for primary care, and that's one of the big aspects of this insurance expansion, get more primary care out to folks, get them out of the emergency rooms. But you didn't make any more doctors, right? There's no more doctors yesterday than there will be tomorrow because you gave people more insurance. So I don't know for sure, but I can't imagine we're not seeing more lining up and wait times for primary care people, or in some parts of the country where there aren't any doctors. If you're going to have a baby, the good news is you have insurance. And the better news is you can bite on the insurance card while you're delivering the baby because there's no OBGYN in your county.
So what's happening either in places like Congress or in the medical infrastructure, the AMA, whatever, to deal with shortages of primary care physicians, of OBGYNs, or whatever else there is where there just aren't enough people doing it? What are they doing about that?
Profession wars. That's what's going on.
What does that mean?
So I think nurses should get more authority. You can't wait for the medical schools to graduate more doctors. You got to give them a little more authority to prescribe some things, to do more stuff.
I agree.
That's just how it's got to be. Some states like Alaska have already dealt with it because they're so big and sprawling that, they don't have doctor coverage in a lot of places. So it's not like we haven't experimented with it. Extending things, you know, pharmacists could do more. Dentists could do more. Physician assistants are out there. We need more of them. So medical schools, we've added some new ones. That's good. There are probably 8 or 10 new medical schools opened up in the past, 3 or 4 years. But, you know, before you see those doctors, you know how long that's going to be? 8 to 10 years. So in the interim, what's going on is the doctors are fighting with the nurses are fighting with the social workers are fighting with anybody. They're all fighting with each other about who's going to get authority.
That's
and
good.
The patients are waiting in the
waiting in line somewhere. Exactly.
You know, our
so again,
cap.
You know. You go. Let's face it. Yeah, we'd probably all like to have a NYU trained doctor. I was going to say Harvard, but NYU trained doctor,
exactly,
to take care of us, but. It's not the reality of how the manpower is out there. So we got to expand and expand fast to keep in step with these benefits that we just gave out. I'd say put down your weapons, professional societies, and let's, you know, be commonsensical.
We're talking to Art Kaplan. We're about to talk about, I have to say, a term I learned this week that is my new favorite term, at least of the week.
Not kumquat?
No, it is free-range parenting. And it
oh,
doesn't...
yes.
Now, before we get into what it is, here's a 911 call in Silver Spring, Maryland, from this guy who is worried about what he sees, which are two unaccompanied kids.
How may I help you?
Walking my dog.
Okay.
Two kids that are unaccompanied, and they've been walking around for probably about 20 minutes by themselves.
Okay, how old do they look?
Maybe seven. Little boy, maybe about seven, eight. Little girl, maybe about six.
Okay, and you don't see any parents around them?
No, ma'am.
Okay, so this is the case of these parents, these free-range parenters down in Silver Spring, Maryland, who have been found guilty of unsubstantiated neglect by the Child Protective Services, or responsible, I should say, for unsubstantiated mm-hmm. neglect. Basically, what they're doing is they're letting their kids, and they're not 7 and 8, actually, they're 6 and 10, but walk home from this park by themselves alone. They've done it twice. This is the second time they got in trouble for it.
How far is it? A mile away?
A mile.
Yeah.
And they're under, investigation by Child Protective Services down there. So I'm curious what you think about this, Art. Have these people committed a neglect crime, or are the rest of us just busybodies?
Oh, this is a great topic. And you're talking to Art Kaplan, little Art, who walked many miles to Saxonville Elementary School in Framingham, unaccompanied, usually shoved out the door by his parents, unwilling to take that dangerous walk, didn't want to go to school. But up and down the streets of Framingham, he trotted, and no one saved him. No one called the cops. They just left him out there wandering around in the second, third, and fourth grade. And by the way, snow, sleet, and hail. Let me just add.
Yeah.
So when I wasn't writing on my slate with a piece of charcoal, I have some experience with this. I also rode my bike to every town nearby, and no one. I was gone all day. I and my friends used to play, you know, pickup games. No parents were around. We played all over town. So my point is, there was a time when this was not some kind of a movement. It was just life.
Yeah.
I think the other thing I'd mention is, despite all the terrible headlines, bad news, internet sort of transmission of YouTube horrors, milk cartons with the disappeared kids and the whole thing, you know, it's never been safer to be a kid. The data says child abductions and all that sort of stuff blown way out of proportion by heavy media coverage of when they happen. But they're almost always by people who yeah. are married and somebody stealing the kid because of part of divorce things or something.
Yeah.
You know, I am so with you. Obviously, we're going to talk to our listeners about this in a couple of minutes. And obviously, there are some circumstances where it's inappropriate. I assume nobody mm-hmm. is disagreeing
yep.
with that. But the flip side of this, the other term that I love and hate simultaneously, this helicopter parenting. I don't do what you do. I don't have your skills. It is so clear to me that it is crushing a sense of independence mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in kids and making them scared and all these kinds of horrible things. So I have to say, well, I don't know these parents at all, and I surely don't know these kids. My sense is go free range. Let your kids have some freedom. And if there's any reason to rein them in, then rein them in.
Yeah. My attitude is be sensible. You know, it's sort of, do we want them wandering around, walking a mile at midnight? Probably not.
Right.
We want them, send them down to pick up something at the store if it's a mile away at 12 o'clock. If they're 10 years old. You know, my son was babysat by somebody across the street at age 12.
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
She came over and watched them. I didn't really, you know, it crossed my mind. Is that girl going to be able to handle problems? But, you know, her parents were nearby, and that was kind of independence for both of them in a certain way. And I felt that environment was pretty safe to do it in. So
Okay,
but
I'm going to play.
I'm
going to play devil's advocate here because I think, I mean, you know, like you are, and I was all running around, but there was a flasher on the corner up from our house. We all knew it was. Everybody ran by him on the way to school. No one cared to anybody even to tell their parents. I mean, you just crossed the street and ran. But anyway, I know it was a total.
See, crazy. They're building a sense of responsibility.
Exactly. Stay away from the flasher. But in any case, you know, being a mother, and I think mothers are the ones who get blamed all the time for this kind of thing. I know in my neighborhood when my kids were little, and I live in a pretty safe neighborhood, you know, surrounded by Boston, nice little leafy suburb. You would be judged very harshly by the fellow mothers and even to some degree the teachers if your kids were coming into school by themselves in kindergarten or in first grade. I mean, there's something has changed. I don't know if it's because of the difference between working moms and stay-at-home moms. We're all judging each other, or the part-time moms, or just the fact that we only have two children now instead of seven children, and everybody's so hyper about their kids.
Yeah, that's a good point, by the way. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this before to Jim. You know, he has seven kids, a couple of them went to jail. Well, you know. Yeah. The other five were fine, so you were vindicated as a parent. I mean, you know what I mean? The Messiah is born thing has happened since we were kids.
Yeah, the ante goes up, you're right, on risk avoidance. If you have one kid or two kids, it's absolutely true. You can see it in China, by the way, you know, the push to make that kid perfect because there's only one of them and it's got to be a success. Look, I think you got to breed some independence and some self-reliance and some what we in the ethics trade call virtues into kids. And if there is a world out there, it's a little risky and a little dangerous, but it's not as bad as, so to speak, the media or social media or the internet makes it seem. It's actually probably just as safe as when we were growing up and we had more freedom. So I think you do want to have that happen. I don't want to jail parents who let their kids wander around if they're doing it when they're 4 and 6. I think that's trouble, and they need to get a little lecture from the cops. If they're doing it when they're 10 and 12, it doesn't bother me as much. I do want to say one other thing, though, about this description of the movement as free range.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't pick it because in the animal world, free range means dinner.
Oh, yeah.
That's an excellent point, Art Kaplan. So what's the podcast?
Going to take a look at this issue we're talking about right now with parental responsibilities and liabilities. And what other oddball issues come up? Turns out that placebos, people given placebo respond differently. We always knew that. We always thought it was in their head. But it turns out some people are biologically more predisposed to fire signals, even if you just give them a sugar pill or aspirin. So the whole idea of the placebo in clinical trials, we're probably going to have to take another look at it.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Oh, we got to talk about that next week.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
Art, have a great week. Great to speak to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Art Kaplan. Art Kaplan joins us every Wednesday. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center and host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Coming up, we're going to ask you about free-range parenting. Is this neglect or a better alternative to having kids cooped up and hovering over the time? That's where we get the term, of course, helicopter parents. We're asking you, free range or hovering? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.